Hello, listeners. Get ready to cast your ballots, because today we're going to be talking about election. And our first nominee is Becky Deanna.
Hi, this is Becky Deanna. Vote for me for student body president. I'll make sure Pepsi is the only cola served in the cafeteria, that we get one Friday off a month to go to the movies, and I'll institute a class to help expand your social media presence and Twitter profile. Remember to vote for me on election day, Becky Deanna.
There's much common ground with me and my colleague. I'm Martin Kessler, and if you vote for me, you won't just get the option to have Pepsi, but Coke as well, because I don't just believe in Coke or Pepsi, I believe in freedom. And that's really what I'm running on, so if you believe in freedom, vote for me, Martin Kessler. And if you're still with us, we're going to be talking about Alexander Payne's film Election, starring Reese Witherspoon and Matthew Broderick. It's about a high school election, although there's plenty of plot jammed in there. I guess the main characters, you have Tracy Flick, who's the go-getter type, I guess you could say, who wants to be the school president. You have Matthew Broderick, who plays the high school teacher, who really doesn't want to see her succeed. And they're the main characters. And you have a few other supporting characters who get involved in the campaign as well. Like there's the Metzlers. There's Paul Metzler, who's like the
jock
who's like that. He comes across like just kind of a nice, genuine guy, but he's such an airhead.
Yeah. he's and he's so sweet.
So clueless. Yeah, he's very sweet, but just like kind of empty-headed. Uh-huh. And then his sister Tammy Betzler, who's kind of the anarchic populist I'm gonna tear it all down type candidate,
right? Like the third party candidate, like a Ross Perot.
Sure. And there's a scandal in which Matthew Broderick's character tries to ensure that Paul Metzler wins instead of Tracy Flick, because he really doesn't want to see her succeed, but he gets found out and disgraced, and she gets to become president after all. And after moving to New York and living in this tiny cramped apartment, he sees her and throws a slushie at her. That's basically the story. But do you like Election, Becky? What do you think of it?
Oh my gosh, this is one of my favorite films of all time. It's in my top 15. When we originally talked about doing our first FlixWise Canada episode together, I kind of listed a few of my movies that I thought would be great topics, and this was one of them. And we ended up deciding Amelie, but you're like, this is something that I really want to do. And it worked out really well that the Criterion, that it was put out on Criterion last month in December. So then we could, you know, have like a new DVD to look at, a Blu-ray to look at and kind of pour over it. But I think this movie is brilliant. It came out in April 1999. It went wide in May 1999, but it was my senior year in college when it came out. So it came out about a month before I graduated college. And I remember sitting in my school cafeteria in college, gushing about it, just loving it with a friend of mine. And it came out about a year or about 6 months after Rushmore, which was kind of similar, like both high school, they're different. But I remember my friend was like team Rushmore and I was team Election, but we both really loved both films. It was sort of like the female male and the male. They're very different though, but they both were overachievers. Well, I don't know if he's overachiever and that he's a bunch of clubs, but I don't know if he's like the smartest person in the whole world. But I
could see them being like total enemies.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. They're both in like a lot of clubs though. But I remember just both of us, I talked to a friend of mine who was a team Rushmore, and he was saying how he stood up and at the end of Rushmore and was like clapping. He was so in love with it. And that's kind of how I felt with Election. I saw multiple times after it came out. I thought it was so brilliant and hilarious. I thought the script was just perfection. I loved all the dark humor. And then just the Native American scream associated with Tracy in several parts in the film. That's from, you know, that spaghetti Western Navajo Joe. It's just brilliant. And then all the uses of screen wipes and the voiceovers and everything about the movie. I just absolutely loved it. And I absolutely loved the ending, which we can talk about too at some point, that that wasn't the original ending, but I thought the ending is just, I mean, it couldn't make the movie more perfect.
it's really the cherry on top.
Yeah.
I was thinking, actually, thinking back to Amblée, how much of that film, we talked a lot about the editing and how precise it was. And this film, I thought also there's some, maybe some similarity in just how well constructed it is in the editing and how many jokes are made in the editing. Like, one of the very first ones that cracks me up is the fifth leg on the chair table, and it, like, all sorts of weird little jokes like that. And of course you have the freeze frames, which are very funny, which frames they choose to stop on while they explain the characters.
Yeah.
And it's like explained through the point of view of another character, so their bias comes through and how they see these other people.
It's so brilliant. Yeah, I thought the editing techniques were so effective. Like the rear screen projection, I thought was really funny when they do all that, and then they use the stock
footage.
Like the
Fellini movie, like it's...
yeah. Just to show how Mr. Ebb feels after he's had an affair with this next... He's like driving down the street and he's all of a sudden in Italy.
He thinks he's Mastroianni, yeah.
Yeah. But all the quick cuts and everything, I just thought that it worked so well. And I guess you can kind of see them as cheesy, but they're not. I think they all work so perfectly well. It's funny, the freeze frames, the filmmakers have talked about that Reese Witherspoon didn't know that they were going to do those freeze frames. And when she saw the first screening, she's like, what's happening? She realized that they saw the humor in that. And then she's like, oh, I didn't really see that as funny. But and that they chose really unflattering.
It's like the least flattering
frame
possible.
But I don't think she was upset by that. I think she was just thrown by, wait, I had that whole scene of dialogue and you freeze frame me. But it's just brilliant and such a great satire. And it's so funny, you know, at the end, when I saw There Will Be Blood, I remember loving There Will Be Blood, the end, so much. I was giddy when he's like, I'm finished. That ending, and that's how giddy, it's kind of similar to the ending I felt with Election. I was so giddy when Mr. M throws that slushy and then he just goes off and he's like, who the F does she think she is? Like, it's just perfect. It's brilliant.
For a minute you think he's gonna take the higher ground and maybe he's actually growing a little bit as a person, but no, he just can't let it go. And it's such a kind of like impotent gesture, throwing this milkshake or slushy or whatever it is, but you just feel all this pent up rage behind it, and then he runs for it. And I sort of wondered if one reason why the film kind of gets away with a lot of the satire is because it's in that high school setting. Like, you know, the stakes are only so high for high school presidency that you can kind of enjoy seeing all these different points of view and the vote casting scandal, you know, if votes aren't picked or, you know, things like that. What do you think about the satire of it?
I think picking high school is perfect because you're right. I also think that the election is sort of like a backdrop to sort of these character studies of these two main characters of Mr. McAllister and Tracy Flick. But I thought it's cool in researching when I was, we were about to do this podcast, that I learned that the writer actually was inspired by this script based on a real high school scandal that happened in 1892 at a high school in Wisconsin. And it was this girl, she was elected as homecoming queen, and she was 5 months pregnant. And the school officials were so upset that she got picked that they burned her ballots, and the runner up is who won, that was announced the winner. And then they realized that this was the case, and I guess they had an investigation. The superintendent did an investigation, and I guess the principal had to resign, and other administrators were reprimanded. It was like a huge thing, and
it's,
I thought,
so
that
ridiculous.
Like, that's crazy that they didn't want the pregnant girl to win, so they burned her ballots. What is that? It's just the people have their pent up morality. That,
again,
like
the stakes are so low in high school. Like, why would anyone care? But for some of these people,
I don't know. Like, they. Like, I don't want her to be a role model because she's pregnant, I guess. It's so crazy. But the whole election, and then I think that they also said the other thing they were inspired by was the race of George Bush against Clinton, and then Ross Perot came, that third candidate who was like the wild card and just wanted everything to be different and burn it all down and be different.
Also, maybe not so much the last American election, but the one before, in the primaries, there were people sort of, when it looked like it was either going to be Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, I remember seeing like comparisons between Hillary Clinton and Tracy Flick that was sort of one that came up a lot.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
And I think in the special features, Alexander Payne mentioned that Barack Obama said that election's his favorite political movie.
Yeah, he said on two separate occasions, Obama said that that's his favorite political movie. I hope it's because he just thinks it's a great satire and not because he thinks that Hillary Clinton's Tracy Flick. I really like Tracy Flick. And the book, mm-hmm. this movie is based on a book, but I think the book has a more like sexualized Tracy Flick than the movie actually has. But I think she's I perceive the movie maybe different than other people, but I think she's kind of sympathetic. And when there's that teacher who, she ends up having an affair with, she's underage and he's preying on her and she's alone. She doesn't really have a lot of friends. Yeah. And she's so
crying. We're in love.
I know. It's so funny. But when he's like seducing her, she just looks so sweet when she's in the, like after all the people have left in that restaurant and he's looking at her and saying, maybe if you're so, because of who you are, you might end up being alone and I appreciate you. And she looks so sweet there. And so I don't know, like sometimes people perceive her as someone that breaks all the rules just to get ahead. But even the poster, when she knocks down the posters in that scene where she starts to rip, she sees one of her posters starting to rip. She tries to put it back. And then when she ends up standing on a trash can to help put it back up and falls and ends up ripping down her whole poster and out of rage just tears down all of her competitors' posters. But it's obviously not like a premeditated thing, which I don't know if is any better because she still does it.
I think what a lot of people get that feeling of her from is the scene that follows when she gets called in. Mr. McAllister knows that she did it or strongly suspects, but she just won't fess up to it. She kind of tries to make it sound, tries to play it down. And then Tammy Metzler, she confesses to it instead because, again, she's sort of the wild card. And Tracy just lets her take the fall and she's totally fine with that.
Yeah, yeah, that's great to put out. He's like, quit while you're ahead, because she's like, I'll get you for my posters.
Like, she always goes just a little bit too far. And like, I think you're right, she's definitely like a sympathetic character. But I mean, we have a Macbeth podcast episode in the works. So like right away when she's ripping down the posters and she has blood on her hands, like I thought right away, oh, like they're treating her a little bit like a Lady Macbeth.
Yeah.
Her ambition, she's gotta stomp on the people in the way.
Yeah. They I think there was a scene that they cut right after that she's washing her hands and she can't get the blood off, and they said it was very Lady Macbeth. So they did, I think they did intend for that. But when Mr. McAllister is questioning Tracy about the posters, that whole exchange, I mean, she's such a badass. Like, I think because he starts, getting to her, and that's why I think sometimes in a little way
she spins it around on him.
I kind of admire her because she did it and she's spinning it, but like I wish sometimes, like, I mean, just to be that confident and to be able to like speak that eloquently and just turn it around, like how he's like, a certain former colleague made a mistake. And then I like how she goes, I don't know what you're referring to, but maybe if a certain older, wiser people hadn't acted like such little babies and gotten so mushy, then everything would be okay. Like, that's just one part. It's just like, oh my god, I love her. And then the whole thing about not getting his wife pregnant, you're like, what? It's like insane. And I just love that look on his face, so he's just blinking because he just can't believe that this girl turned it around on him. So that scene, I mean, although it's like, I think some people might not like her, it's kind of funny, like Broadcast News is my second favorite film of all time. And some people don't like Albert Brooks because he's sort of a know-it-all in that movie. And I just adore him in that movie. And it's funny when I let people borrow that movie, sometimes they'll come back and be like, oh, he's kind of a jerk. And I'm like, wait, what? No, he's just standing up for, I think he's just so annoyed that this other journalist is getting all this attention because he's the good-looking one and really not because of his smarts. And I think that's what Tracy too.
He's trying to prove like he doesn't care about the news, like he's just manipulating this,
right?
Like he's,
and then he gets in, there's a scene in Broadcast News where they're at a party and he starts like questioning him, like how many senators are there, like we might do capital estates next. Like, it's totally crappy, but it's funny because he just wants to know, does this guy actually know what he's talking about? But that's the thing here. I think that Tracy looks at her competitor Paul Metzler and she's just like, oh, he's just this rich kid and he's just popular and all that stuff. So I think she's annoyed with that.
She's so upset when she first sees he's running. Like, she comes up and says, like, who put you up to this? Like, she knows he couldn't have thought of it on his own. Like, he has to have been a puppet.
I totally was a puppet.
But, I mean, her real opposition, it's the Mr. McAllister. And, like, it's sort of funny just reading online some people's responses to the film. Like, the film seems to change wildly depending on who people relate more to. Mm-hmm. And for some people, Mr. McAllister is the hero and Tracy Flick's the villain of the film. And I don't know if it's because, like, each character has enough depth to them mm-hmm. that somebody could see themselves in them and then just buy into that perspective. But I think we're meant to have a little bit more of, like, a distant, ironic view when looking at that antagonism between them. Like, sort of get the sense Tracy doesn't like Mr. McAllister because she's going somewhere in life and he's just this blockade, he's an obstacle, and he doesn't like her, like, deep down, I think, because he knows that she's going somewhere in her life and he's not.
Yeah.
He's stuck. And it was sort of interesting, I think, in the one of the special features, Alexander Payne talked about how he wanted to try and associate Mr. McAllister with circles, like he's drawing the oranges or he's going around the track,
right.
And Tracy Flick
and
with straight lines. Yeah, so, like, just to emphasize that point that he's just going around in circles in his life, or maybe even spiraling downwards, and she's going in a straight line. She has a lot of direction in her life, and that juxtaposition with the characters is where the main tension of the film maybe comes from.
Yeah, and there's a part in the end before he actually does steal those two votes and puts them in the trash can, when he sees that Tracy is so excited because she knows
he's gonna let it go, and he just sees her face.
And I know, it is. I've written down what his voiceover, because it's so brilliant. He's like, the sight of Tracy in the window affected me in a way I can't fully explain. Part of it was that she was spying, but mostly because it was her face. Who knew how high she would climb in life? How many people would suffer because of her? I had to stop her. And it's like, oh my God, like, what? Where is this coming from? Like, had to stop her. Like, he doesn't want. Yeah. It's those people that don't want someone else to win. And I also think it's because he's upset because his friend had an affair and his friend was brought down, but she wasn't brought down. But I mean, I think it's amazing that, like, they were able to hide this in this high school, were able to hide this controversy. Like, her whole life could be ruined if people had found out that she was part of this affair. But I also don't think it was her fault. And I think it's great that people don't know about it, that she was sheltered from that. Because it was this teacher that preyed on her. So I think he's just like, well, you're lucky that you wouldn't win an elect, like that time where he's going tit for tat for her. Like, you're lucky that people don't know about this indiscretion, or else you wouldn't even be able to win it, which is insane. So it's just, he is kind of crazed because of her. She really gets under his bones.
Well, what do you think of the depiction of high school life in the film? Because as stylized as the film is, with all these editing techniques we talked about, and it also does kind of capture what mm-hmm. high school can feel like sometimes. And I thought it was interesting that they shot in a real working high school, like during a semester. It wasn't shot during a summer. So a lot of the actors in the film were real high school students, just basically playing themselves. I know the actor who played Paul Metzler, Chris Klein, I thought he was an actor before Election, but I think they said he was mm-hmm. just like one of the high school students, and they cast him, and that was the beginning of his film career, and he's so perfectly cast. But, like, I think it's a little bit heightened, but, you know, even the fact that it does touch on some of these little bit darker subjects, like, mm-hmm. you know, I'm sure most people have heard of one scandal happening at their high school, or, you know, like those sort of things that don't usually get talked about in films.
Yeah, I thought that the depiction of high school was great. Like, I love how Alexander Payne, one of the things he likes to do is make things very authentic, and this film seems very authentic. Like how you were saying, every single extra and student in the film is a real high school student from Omaha. I mean, Reese Witherspoon's an actress, Matthew Broderick is, but Chris Klein, I mean, they did want to cast major actors in the major roles, but Chris Klein was somebody they found at a high school that was, like, in a lot of plays. He played Tony and West Side Story, but, like, someone had mentioned him, and he met him, and he really liked him. He's like, oh, this, he was really impressed by him. But then he went back to LA and interviewed a bunch of actors and didn't really see anyone that he thought was good enough, and he called Chris Klein. And then I think that they said Thora Birch was capped in the
right.
Tammy Metzler role. So he Yeah, and so she was supposed to be in it, and everyone was excited because she was a real actress, but I guess something about her didn't really work. And then he found this other girl who was wanting to be an actress. He found her on a tape, but she had braces, and he really liked that she had braces, but she was someone who wanted to act, but she hadn't really been in anything. Chris Klein was, again, someone who wanted to act, but hadn't been in anything. And then the kid that I was most impressed with is the kid who, when they're counting the ballots at the end,
right,
the really tall kid, I can't remember his name, but he...
He believes in the system. I know.
Yeah, just with the system and this. Well, I don't know the rules. No one's told me, you know. And he kind of seems like a young Jim McAllister, maybe how he was, and then look what he's become. But I thought he was...
Is he the one that spits at Matthew Broderick near the end? Yeah.
He's so great. And I forgot to look up his... but he actually went on to... That was... I think he was just a high school kid that was cast in the high school, but he actually went on to act, and he's been in other things. I haven't... didn't really look at his filmography, but I think that's awesome. But he was so great. And it's kind of funny too, that scene at the end of the movie where that kid is accusing him of, well, I don't know, the votes aren't really adding up. And the way they filmed that, they, whenever Alexander Payne was talking on the commentary, which I thought was really interesting, that he says that Matthew Broderick, the way he's filming him is, he's always sort of tilted, like he's off kilter, but when he's filming right. the kid, he's just very straight and narrow. He's the center of the frame. So it's just to show how different they are. That's one of my, and the principal is one of my favorite characters too.
He feels like a real principal.
He's just great. And then the janitor apparently is a real janitor. That's crazy, because it's like the whole movie sort of like the revenge of the janitor, because in the beginning of the movie, Matthew Broderick's throwing stuff in a trash can and he misses and it falls on the ground, and the janitor kind of looks at him, and the janitor at the end of the movie is the one that finds those two votes. But they said that the janitor was actually the janitor in the production house or whatever, where Alexander Payne, I guess his office is. They liked the janitor's look so much, they asked him to be in the movie, and the only thing they had him change was his glasses. Which is crazy, because he looks like an actor. Like,
When he's at the end and he's just like part of that group that's giving him the disapproving look when the editing's going faster and faster. Like, it's just the right face to include in that group to make it feel like Matthew Broderick's character's life's collapsing inwards.
Yeah.
And just all the little setups and payoffs are fantastic. Like, just in the way the film's constructed. Like, of course, you mentioned the trash, like how that becomes Mr. McAllister's undoing, but even like little things, like I like when he's explaining the oranges versus apples as a metaphor for democracy, and the Paul Metzler is just like, I also like bananas. And then like two scenes later, when he's coming back to his home and he picks the banana off of the plate, like weird little setups and payoffs like that just make it very funny in a very well-constructed way. It's not like the kind of comedy where you see people doing a lot of improv and then it's just sort of like shaped in the editing. Like, it feels very, very thought out, and everything's sort of constructed in ahead of time to make it work the way it does.
Yeah,
I like that a lot.
I like how is in the heard at the beginning of the movie when Reese goes up to Matthew Broderick in the car, or Tracy to Mr. M, and talks about how Mr. M's like, oh, you know, this should be easy for you. You know, so far, no competition, because she doesn't have any running mate. And she's like, well, Coca-Cola is by far the number one soft drink, and they spend more money than anyone on advertising. I guess that's how they stay number one. And then, like, his look on his face, like, he's like, I can't believe this is happening. And then you see him later drink like when he's throwing in the trash can, he throws away a Pepsi. And then later you see him drinking a Pepsi. It's just like little things are so funny.
Yeah.
And she's like, Coke is number one, blah, 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 blah. Oh, my God. It's just, there's such small things. And trash is such a big, I mean.
Yeah, it's always garbage day.
Yeah, it's always garbage day. And how she throws away the posters and he throws away stuff in the trash can, and how the end of the movie ended up being that he threw away those two votes. And it's just like his life is just, I mean, he's just constantly, I don't know, like the trash is following him everywhere.
Well, even at the end, like him throwing that Slurpee, like it's him throwing trash, and you sort of feel there's some sort of association with the character and just garbage that's inescapable. Which,
right.
I mean, that's funny. One thing that's really interesting is the casting of Matthew Broderick, because probably even now his most famous film role is the Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where he's like the cool high school kid who gets everything and gets his day off and gets away with it. And Ferris Bueller's Day Off, one of the things that's sort of impressive about that film is there's like basically no dramatic tension. It's just like maybe a little bit when the when the principal's chasing him and follows him to his home, but like even that's deflated so quickly. The only character that has sort of dramatic tension is his friend Cameron, but just the casting of like, hey, it's cool Ferris Bueller playing this guy whose life is falling apart, who's working in the high school. Like, he comes across like the principal from Ferris Bueller or like Ben Stein from Ferris Bueller a little bit.
There's even a scene where he's like, anybody in the beginning, because he doesn't want to answer Tracy Flick's, like, she's holding her hand up and he's like, I don't want her to be the one to answer. And he's like, anybody, please.
Yeah, like a lot of the voiceover feels like the asides that Ferris Bueller would have. So like in a lot of ways, you sort of feel like you're watching Ferris Bueller all grown up, which it's very ironic to see it like that. But you also kind of feel like, oh, I guess maybe that's where that character would end up.
Yeah. So. It's so funny. It's funny. I was reading how Jason Reitman was really inspired by this movie, and he was able to screen. He programmed several weeks of movies at the New Beverly in 2010. And one of the doubles was he put Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Election together as a double feature. And he said, like, this is sort of what happened to Ferris Bueller. Like, he became a teacher. But I was looking at something else he was saying, that Matthew Broderick's sort of in control of the world versus the world is in control of him in this in Election. Mm-hmm. And that there were oddly perfect sides of the same coin. Because in the last year of high school in Ferris Bueller, you're like, oh, I could do anything. Like, there's opportunities are endless. And then when you're in Election, you're like, oh my God, this is my life now. But he always talks himself into like, oh, this is great. Like, everything's going to be great. And just, it's just, even at the end, he talks himself into saying that's great.
Yeah, like I don't know if some of that like erotic distance is lost on people, but we were talking a little bit before we started recording about the Wikipedia synopsis where, I think it's very clearly written by somebody who totally identifies with the Mr. McAllister character, and sort of I think doesn't realize that that character's in a worse place than he's trying to communicate to himself in the voiceover or communicate to the audience.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Like, it's funny how before this podcast, you asked me, you're just like, oh, I'm reading the Wikipedia thing just to kind of brush myself up. And then we talked this whole conversation about it. It's like Mr. M wrote the synopsis of it. Cause it's so funny. Like, there was this one part that we found that I thought was so funny where, he says, well, Jim is forced to resign. To add insult to injury, Jim's wife kicks him out of the house when he tries to apologize for what happened with Linda. You're like, what? That's how you perceived it, Wikipedia entry person? So
it like very much paints Tracy Flick as like, oh, she must be stopped in the synopsis. Yeah. Like this.
Yeah, it's definitely a fun read if you get a second to go to the Election Wikipedia entry, because it's so one-sided. Like, Tracy's the worst. And it says that she's like over-sexualized, which she apparently is in the book, but not really so much in the movie. So it's like, whoa, this guy had, or girl, whoever wrote it, probably someone who relates to Mr. M, is very on Mr. M's side, Mr. McAllister's side.
I mean, one thing that I enjoy about the film is just kind of being in the different perspectives, and each point of view of the character is like a little bit heightened or extreme. So like, you're never like fully on board with every character, but like you can kind of see where they're coming from and see maybe what they're oblivious of or what they're in denial of, or what they overestimate about themselves or underestimated to others.
They're all so three-dimensional, and it's nice to see all sides of them. Like I said, I'm kind of rooting for Tracy, but I mean, you definitely see, it's nice to see where Mr. M is coming from too, and all the other characters and Tracy. It gives them just so much depth to have those voiceovers. And even when they do the prayers, it's so funny. That kind of reminded me of Heathers. Like, the movie.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, when they all sit around and like, early admission to Stanford or whatever, like when they're praying over this dead body and stuff. So I think Election's probably a better made movie. It has a better ending than the Heathers ending. But Heathers is, I think I love Heathers more than I love Election, just because I was obsessed with it when I was 14, and I just think it's brilliant. But Election's probably is the better movie, but they definitely have sort of the same DNA.
Yeah, like you can see a lot of DNA of these sort of 80s high school movies coming back in Election. And in some ways, Election feels like a little bit of a response. Like, we mentioned the John Hughes movies, like partly in their construction and partly just how it kind of twists or plays them that view of high school life, and maybe makes it a bit darker or more honest depending on how you look at it. Like, Election feels a little bit like it takes place in that universe, I guess, or that world. I was thinking even like Mr. McAllister, that's the same name as the as the family in Home Alone, you know, which, I mean, John Hughes didn't direct that, he wrote it, but, like, I always think of Home Alone 2, the Mr. McAllister, the father on the tape recorder, so I was thinking of that over and over again watching
this.
That is so
funny, I didn't think about that.
You know, it feels almost like when you're watching Election that a lot of these characters could maybe bump into, you know, characters from Heathers or, you know, from Breakfast Club, like, it kind of has that feel to it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Alexander Payne said something interesting, which I'd assume he cast him because he thought Matthew Broderick, because he was in Ferris Bueller. But when he did the commentary, which was on the first DVD because he recorded it in 1999, and then the commentary on the Blu-ray mm-hmm. that just they released, it's the same commentary recorded back right when the movie opened. But at that point, he said he had still never seen Ferris Bueller, but he might have seen it by now. I don't know. But he liked him in other stuff and then, you know, knew about Ferris Bueller. But I thought that was so interesting that he hadn't seen Ferris Bueller, or even when he cast him that he didn't want to see him. Maybe he didn't want it to cloud his vision of it or anything.
Maybe. I sort of feel like Ferris Bueller, that's one of those movies that even if you don't see, you still kind of know everything yeah. about it. Like, yeah. it's just one of those movies that's totally permeated pop culture. You know, like, I remember it was sort of a big deal when they had that, I think it was a Super Bowl ad with Matthew Broderick, where, like, first people got, like, super excited that, like, oh, is this going to be, like, a Ferris Bueller's Day Off too? Like, there's still a bunch of people where if you told them, hey, there's a Ferris Bueller's Day Off 2 coming out, they would get so excited, you know?
Yeah, you could see Election as sort of a sequel, but people probably would never accept that.
No, I think this, if you told them this is Ferris Bueller's Day Off 2, some people would be kind of upset, but
yeah,
it's interesting. And, like, just trying to think of the films that maybe this influenced going onwards, that's interesting that it came out right around the same time as Rushmore, like you pointed out. Because I was thinking, like, there's little bits of this that remind me of some of the later Wes Anderson movies, mm-hmm. like Alexander Payne's doing the like 16 millimeter footage of Tammy on the swing, and the music that plays, like, it reminds me so much of in Royal Tenenbaums when you have the Gwyneth Paltrow flashback,
oh,
and it's
yeah.
all done in like 16 millimeter, and like
yeah.
things like that, you know, and something about the deadpan nature of it and the little bit affected flat delivery, like, you know, I could see maybe Wes Anderson actually enjoying this film. Maybe
I'm curious to see if Wes Anderson likes Election. I think my friend and I sort of did that whole Election team Election versus Team Rushmore, but we both just adored both movies.
Yeah.
So it was just a kind of a fun little competition between them. And I like how one of them is a female lead and one's a male lead.
Yeah. I was wondering, have you seen Citizen Ruth?
No, and I remember, because I was obsessed with, like I said, Election when it came out, that I bought the DVD and I watched the commentary, you know, right after college and everything. And I said it's the same commentary, but I remember they talk a lot about Citizen Ruth. And I didn't even remember that I had seen that commentary until I was listening to it again last week. And I was like, how do I remember all this? And I said, oh, I've actually listened to this before.
Right.
But when I first listened to it, I thought, God, I have to see this movie, Citizen Ruth. It sounds great. And when I rewatched it, the commentary the other day, I'm like, oh, I still can't believe I haven't seen it, and I just didn't have enough time to see it before this podcast. But I wish I had.
Yeah, it's great. Like, it's very similar to Election in its tone and its sense of political satire. Like, you can see why Election was the next natural place for Alexander Payne to go. I've dropped off on some of his more recent films, though. Like, I think I saw Election a little bit later. Like, it definitely wasn't in theaters, and I think it was just like one of those films I was a little bit too young for when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember it was probably maybe in between About Schmidt and Sideways that I saw Election for the first time, because I remember watching it and being like, oh, this is the same person that did About Schmidt. And that movie felt so different for me at the time. And maybe going back and looking now, they might actually seem more similar than I remember. But just something about the tone and the sense of humor felt like really, really different. And then I feel like he's done a bunch of films in between that I probably haven't seen.
Yeah, I just love him. And when Election came out, it's crazy that I never went back and saw Citizen Ruth, but I really loved Sideways. I love Nebraska, and I loved About Schmidt. I didn't like The Descendants. I thought it was just okay.
That's right.
Yeah, right. George Clooney, there was a lot of just goofy stuff I thought in that movie that I just didn't, I mean, maybe I just didn't relate to the main character, I don't know. I wasn't a huge fan of that movie. It was a disappointment to me, and I really disliked Downsizing.
Okay, I hadn't seen it, but I heard a couple of mixed reactions to it.
I was bummed because I every time there's a Payne movie, I'm super excited because of the, you know, election is one of my favorites, and I really do like him, and I like how authentic he is. But I guess the premise was, you know, it was good, and I it's comedy, and but it's just, I thought it sort of fell apart in the end. It was, and I really didn't like one of the main characters. She's kind of felt like a stereotype, and I didn't really like her dialogue, and she really bothered me. She really bothered me, and I just really disliked it, which is a bummer because that's probably the only one of his films that I've ever disliked. I mean, Descendants was okay, but that I just actively disliked. Downsizing, and I discouraged some of my friends were like, oh, well, should I see this one or this one? And I was always like, oh, that's the bottom of the pot. Like, you know, you can take my opinion for what it's worth. But I mean, I
won't be in any rush to see it.
Yeah, I was annoyed in the movie. I also was annoyed at the end. There was a Q&A at the end of the movie with Alexander Payne, which I thought was great. But one of the moderators sort of implied that, like, the movie might have been too smart for people or too intelligent for people to sometimes get it. And that may be even more infuriated that they threw that in there. Like, oh, maybe if you don't love this movie, you're not smart enough. I'm like,
I hate that. I know.
I one of the things I love about Sideways and I love about these films is that they're so, I feel like they find the poetry and just everyday life, and then, you know, and these people feel so real, like where they live and what they do and what their cars look like. And even Election, like the cars are dirty, and then the way they dress, and he made sure that the houses look like this is, I think Alexander Payne talks about when people live in, he doesn't like watching movies where you're like that person as a teacher, and they never could afford a house like that in New York City or whatever.
It's always movies and TV. It's like somebody has a similar job as me, and they have this like giant apartment or condo or, you know. I know.
Yeah, my husband always does that. We'll watch a movie and he's like, there's no way that person could afford that apartment. And he's like, they're a student. But that stuff doesn't bug me as much, but I think it's nice that he's really authentic in that way and wants to be like, okay, the house would be cluttered this way, or this is how that person would dress, or this is what they could afford, or their car wouldn't be this super clean. And so I like that. I also liked how like Tammy and Paul lived in sort of like a new money house. Like it was a tract housing that was, you could still tell it was under construction, that it was building up, and these people had new money. He put so much detail into it.
And Tracy, like her mom's a single parent, and I think they said like she used to be a stewardess, but now she does paralegal work. And,
oh yeah, she's a paralegal. Like,
you sort of get a sense just like from her relationship with her mother, like maybe why her mother would drive her and why she would sort of stoke that fiery ambition in her. Like, it's great at just getting a sense of maybe who these characters are and why they are in the places that they are when you meet them.
Right. And they don't hit you over the head with it. Like her mom is, you know, she said that she never knew her dad, and she's, and then her mom is very like, she writes letters to Connie Chung and like Elizabeth Dole, what made you successful, and gives her a daughter advice. And even it's kind of sad when her daughter doesn't win the election. She's like, oh, you know, maybe you should have taken some of my advice, and maybe you should have put it up more posters.
It's
like, it's like
absolutely not what you want to hear when you just failed at something.
Or when she's comforting her
and she slips her a pill.
Yeah! Like, she gives her a pill, whatever. Oh, have one of my pills. And you're just like, oh. So you kind of see that her mom is driving her. And I guess they also took out a scene with her mom in the kitchen making, like at 5:30 in the morning, making like a gajillion cupcakes. I think Alexander Payne said there was a scene where Tracy kind of says, well, what, mom, what if I don't win? And her mom's like, Tracy Flick's a winner. Like, just like refuses to accept that she won't win. But I also see from the perspective of Tracy Flick, like, you know, what it's like if you're trying to get into high school and you know, you think, okay, this will be good on my resume. And it's also hard just like in growing up, like running for something and not getting it. Like she doesn't get it. She does ultimately get it because she did win, but it's like, it's hard to have that first thing where you're running for something and you've done everything you possibly could and to not get it. I mean, that's part of growing up. And I think some people, millennials do grow up with like people not wanting them ever to be disappointed. And it is hard in college when you're like faced with, I don't know how to handle this, that like, I didn't get this position or something. So I think it's part of growing up. But you see that, though. I also see why she gets so mad at Paul for running against her, because it's like she was running, you know, she didn't have competition, but it was like, I think she would have been fine if she had competition, but nobody wanted to run against her. And then this guy is running against her because someone put him up to it. That makes her even more mad, because he's popular and he's going to get it probably. She has to work so much harder. But I don't think she thought it was a free ride. I think she was still going to do really well with the election and fight for it. It sucks. So you get, I don't know. It's easy for me to relate to her because, you know, I was the president of my like honor society in high school, and I was an FBLA. It's funny, they show her yearbook pictures and she was an FBLA and I was an FBLA too. I was in Future Business Leaders of America, and that I was the president of my residential student government at USC. So it's like, I've done the elections, I've done the whole thing. So I sort of relate to her and in that way, and what that's like.
Like, where I really related to her was near the end when she finally gets to college or university, like that feeling like you work really hard and you think you're going to be surrounded by all these peers, and then like she still doesn't fit in with people, and she's just surrounded by these rich slackers. Like that's where it kind of felt like, oh, I really feel for you, Tracy. Like I get that. And like even just like at work, like I wouldn't call myself a perfectionist, but you know, I try to work hard, and then you get like reprimanded because somebody else at work doesn't do their job and says that you're a toxic perfectionist. I kind of, you know, and, like, even though there's something about Tracy that can kind of come across obnoxious, like I think it's on purpose. In her performance, Reese Witherspoon talked about like holding her jaw a certain way and pronouncing words certain ways. You know, you can understand why people don't like her, but you still sympathize with her and you still kind of want her to succeed, because just like she's the only one in the film that's really driven.
Right. Yeah. And it's funny, the epilogue, Payne says he likes the ending because he says it's honest and suggesting that things really don't change in our lives, that we think we've moved on, but actually we don't, or we can't, because we are who we are, which I thought was really interesting that he said that. And I think that is it interesting too, when they show Tracy walking sort of before you see her in the limo, but at the end of high school, you see her with her yearbook, and she has that small realization that like maybe she's not going to get the personal satisfaction she thinks she's going to get, because she sees like Paul and he has all these friends surrounding her. And even though she won the election, she doesn't have the connections that maybe she thought she'd have, or have friends. And then the same thing with college. But I like, it's funny how she says in Georgetown, a lot of them are just spoiled little rich kids who didn't know how lucky they had it.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. I totally feel
like,
for that.
Maybe what she said here is like, I came to accept that very few people are truly destined to be special, and we're solo flyers. Maybe like Dave said, if you're going to be great, you got to be lonely. But I also think the ending is immensely satisfying, and I like how they give us that ending where I like how she kind of wins in the end. Like she, you see her, she still is like, she's, you know, now working for, she's in D.C.
You get a sense like she's on this trajectory where she's going to go all the way to the top. Like that's how you sort of feel about the character. And like, of course, people are going to hate her along the way. That goes along with that. You know, I think sometimes any person who's after success, you're going to make some people unhappy just to see you become successful.
Right.
I don't know.
But I also think that, like, I don't think anyone would doubt that she earned it or that she would
earn
it.
No, of course not.
And then I think it's even when Mr. M tries to convince Paul to run, and he's, like, so sweet, and he says, but that, no, I don't want to do that. That's Tracy's thing. Like, it's, like, I feel like that actually even the...
Paul doesn't even vote for himself. It's really sweet.
He's,
I know.
So
like,
sweet.
He's so,
I
like,
it could be dishonorable to vote for myself. It's so sweet. But Tracy, I mean, come on. You got to vote for yourself. Everybody
absolutely
knows that.
It's off-putting sometimes for people to see, like, somebody who is willing to go after what they want. You know, like, I think that's just, you know, it's sort of too bad. But, like, people seem to not like somebody who's not humble and who's driven and who wants success. You know, that's... Even though I think that's totally okay to be like that.
It's not like she does everything to get to the top either. Like, I think even that Wikipedia entry made it sound as if she did stepped on people.
Yeah, she could have gone, like, so much further in destroying her opponent.
But also, I thought it's interesting, too, in how the kids in the school, like I was saying, where Paul's being convinced and he's like, oh, that's Tracy's thing. It seems like he genuinely likes Tracy. Like, he's like, that's her thing. She wants to run. And even when you see Tracy with other students. There is that one part where she's like, better take it down. Like when she's putting the poster up, the way she's treating, right. You know, one of the guys helping her. That's not the greatest, but she seems responsive and nice and courteous mm-hmm. to everybody. And it seems like people do like her. You know what? This is so random, but I thought was weird about her speech. She's talking about one of the girls is like, she feels alienated in homeroom. And this person's mom works in the cafeteria. And I'm thinking, do you think those people wanted her to say that? Because it's like, I would be horrified if I was like, yeah, my mom works in, like, I feel like nobody, you know, like maybe they were confiding in her. And then like now the whole school knows that they feel like they were a loner in homeroom. It's I just a small thing that I thought, oh my God, I feel like that'd be horrifying.
Right. No, I hadn't thought about that, but that's a good point.
Yeah, I always think of it different perspectives. I'm like, oh no.
Or that the Paul, like, he's nice to Tracy, but like he's also nice to his sister when she's running. And he's like, I know I don't understand this, but you're still my sister and I love you anyway. Like, he's just so accepting of the fact that she's his competition now.
I know, like I thought it was kind of heartbreaking when she's dancing in a room and he puts the homework under the door and she's like, what do you want? And he's like, oh hey, just thought. And he's being so nice to her and so genuine. Yeah. And she's just like, get out of my room or thanks or whatever. But then I like how he says, you know, I always think you're my sister even though you're adopted. Like, just like small little things. Like, oh okay, I don't think he meant to do that on purpose, but it's funny because it's like, right. Yeah, you're my, everyone loves you, but you know are adopted. So just wanted to remind you of that.
Even Tammy, like her epilogue, it's pretty funny too. Like, and kind of happy where she gets sent off to Catholic school, which doesn't sound like fun, but then she meets the girl there and they're like, you know, even she gets kind of a happy ending. Yeah, I guess the only one who doesn't really get a happy ending is Matthew Broderick's character, even though he tries to talk himself into being like, oh, this is a happy ending. Like, he sort of ends up back to where he started, only worse.
Yeah, I mean, worse. It's so funny. You know, I even like how he's so upbeat, like, the day of the election. One of his voiceovers is how Diane kicked him out of the house wasn't a setback. It was an opportunity. It was like after the election was over. And then he's like, the worst was over. What was the harm? Like, what harm had really been done? No one was dead. And then he goes to, and then he finds out that they all find out about him. But he always tries to be like, this is great. I dream to live in New York and I have a snug little apartment. And now I'm teaching again. And he's like a docent at the museum. It's so funny.
Yeah.
And that's why I think in some ways Payne is, you know, cheering or rooting on Tracy and that she is the hero, because she does get the hero ending. Like, she does end up getting what she, you know, going the trajectory we hope she'd be in. And Mr. M does, like, he doesn't get away with it. I love that he doesn't get away with it. I don't know. I like how he kind of gets it in the end. So you could see, obviously, my bias towards who I like the best.
Well, like, I think the original ending was that they kind of sit in a car, like they meet up later and have kind of a mutual understanding, which I don't think is right, because I don't think those characters would ever understand each other. And you sort of don't necessarily even like the idea of them seeing each other's point of view. Like, I think part of the point of the film is maybe just how limited our own points of view are, you know, with these voiceovers, and how, like, even we lack perspective on ourselves, you know, that other people might have of us. So, like, I think it is kind of fitting that it ends the way it does. Even the Mr. Novotny gets, like, a little epilogue. I was just thinking now, when she's saying, like, I wonder if he ever finished his novel, and he's just working at, like, some minimum wage job.
And he's putting price tags on, like,
He's putting the price tags on. He just looks kind of miserable.
The ending is interesting because I never knew about that alternate ending until, just reading more about the movie. But that, yeah, it's like Tracy comes back from college and she, like, I guess Mr. McAllister works at a car dealership. And so she goes in to buy her first car, and then they'd go on a test drive. And then I think he realizes that she lives in a not a very nice neighborhood. So I think he's kind of taken aback by that. I don't know if he assumed that she was rich or anything. It's implied that she isn't in the movie, but then kind of talk about what would you do if I had not won the election. And I think they have sort of a sweet exchange. And then she asked him to sign her yearbook. But I think they said in testing it didn't do well. And then they just thought, like, tonally, it just felt so sweet and, like, didn't feel like fit in with the rest of the movie. But
for a film that's so biting, like, it doesn't feel like the right ending.
Right. But the ending, I mean, is so totally perfect. And I like like, again, I like to see that she got to where she was. And then just that last line when he says, who the F does she think she is? It's just, right. It's like, yes, it's so awesome because it's great. Because she won. It's the, and I love how like the limo like goes screech after he throws a slushie. And that's what's like, crap! You hear
somebody shout at him.
Oh my god, that movie is so, it's just such a, it's a, it's so fun and dark.
Oh, we didn't even talk about the bee sting. That's one of the best parts of the film. It doesn't really add anything to the plot. It's just,
yeah, I don't think it's in the book.
Like, of course he gets stung by a bee. It's it's just like a perfect detail to kind of emphasize that he's becoming more miserable.
Yeah, that bee sting is great. I even like the way that when he gets stung, how he responds to it. And he's like, ow, Jesus. Like, just like the words, because it's like so real. Like, you're thinking, oh my God, that's how you would respond to getting a bee sting. It's hilarious. Like, yeah, I just want to rewind that scene and see it over and over.
And it goes on for so long, the swelling. Yeah. It's in so many scenes. Like, a lot of films, they would just kind of have it swollen up for the following scene, and that's the end of the joke. But you see it there for almost the rest of the movie, I think, up until like the epilogue.
Yeah, and I guess they were saying like the makeup, I guess they had four different looks of it through makeup, like four different stages of it. But I also, it just shows too, like how the people continually ask him through the rest of the movie, what happened to your eye? Are you okay? And he's just like more and more frustrated about it. It just shows just what's happening to him and how he's falling apart. It's just crazy. I also like, there's a scene where he goes back to the hotel room to wait for Linda, and he has like a champagne glass against his eye because he just got stung, and he has a phone, and he's kind of like, he's trapped and he's all suffocating. And Payne says in the commentary, that's a perfect description of just who he is in that frame, where he's got like this phone against his ear and then the champagne against his eye. I like all the little things they put in. They put such thought into like every frame of this movie.
Yeah, there's so much thought into it. Like, oh my God, the phone call he gives her after, when he starts off with like, you ruined my life. I loved you. Bye. Or I love you. Bye. Like, it's like those two completely opposing thoughts like crammed into the same message, you know, that's the sort of response from somebody whose life's coming apart.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I don't even know, I mean, if he really loves her. I just think he's not that even, because it's like, oh, he loves her all of a sudden. Like, I think it's just something new, because he's just like, maybe not that happy with his own life. Like, you can kind of tell he's not that happy. He just talks himself into, oh, it's my best friend, I've been living with her for 9 years, and they have this really dull exchange when they have dinner and stuff. So I just think he's just not that happy, and then this is something new and fresh. But I doubt he's like in love with her after just
I don't think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my god, it's great.
That's so great.
Is there anything we didn't cover that you'd like to make sure we mention?
I mean, I not really. I mean, it's nice to know that the film was well received. Like, it didn't do well at the box office. It kind of bombed. Mm-hmm. I think it made like $14 million at the box office, and it cost like $25 million to make. So it didn't do very well. I think it's because Paramount didn't really know how to market it. They didn't really know what it was. And then I think Sherry Lansing in the end got really behind it and got the marketing team to support it with like a premiere at the Egyptian and all that. But I think it was sort of too late because the marketing materials didn't really reflect the movie. But it was nice to know the movie got an Academy Award nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay. It got a Golden Globe nomination for Witherspoon and Best Actress. And then it won the Independent Spirit Award for Best Film. So I always love the Independent Spirit Awards, because I feel like my favorite movies of the year usually get love at the Independent Spirit Awards. So I love that. But it's nice to know that people love this movie. And like I said, I became obsessed with it when it came out, and I like told everybody about it. I just loved it so much.
And it also, you know, I think this is kind of what made Reese Witherspoon more of a star, right? Like, I know she had been in a bunch of films before, like Fear and Pleasantville and...
Yeah, Man in the Moon.
Was she in Man in the Moon?
Yeah, that was her first movie. She was like a little girl. That was her first role. It's a different movie. It's a different movie what you're thinking, because I think there was two movies called Man in the Moon. It was this movie about in this small town where she fell, like had her first kiss in the movie.
Andy Kaufman movie. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It was more of like a romantic film, but as a girl, I just loved it. She was just so charming in that movie. And I think that was her first major role. So she was in that. And I like the story when she talks about when she goes in to try out for this movie with Alexander Payne, that she said that she really wanted this role, and that she said that she told them, like, she, because she's from the Midwest, that she said she knew where this person was from and what motivated her. And then she essentially was all Tracy Flick on them, and she said, if you cast someone else, it'll be a mistake. And
that's exactly what would make you think that that person's perfect to play Tracy
Flick.
And
I think she said that when she left, she was like, I don't know what came over me. I don't know why I told them that. But I think that's why Alexander's like, Payne's like, oh my God, she's Tracy Flick. I love her. Right. She's perfect. She's so brilliant in this, and I love all the different choices she made. And she talks even like about just Alexander Payne directing her, though, about how like he's very like, gave her a lot of animal direction, like, you're a panther here, like walk down the hall like you're a panther. And so she understood. She's like, okay, I'm like, you know, this is how I'm gonna be. And then I also love the direction he gave her, where when she finds out that she won,
oh, the jumping like a pogo stick.
Yeah, because they said that she was sort of kind of sweet and like, oh, she's excited, but he's like, no, act like you're a human pogo stick. And it's just so perfect, her jumping
just
up and down,
the energy coming out of that, like, that's the one thing she wanted, and now she knows, and she's just like, she can't contain herself. She's bouncing up and down. It's so funny. And that's right when he sees her, and he's like, that face, like, I couldn't let her win.
Oh my God. So I feel like we're just like, is this like Amelie episode? We're just like literally gushing.
I know, it's just
like
gushing at this point.
Yeah, it's like, stop talking about, remember this part? And what about this part? But it's just, I mean, I think that if you love this movie, it's definitely worth a rewatch. And the commentary is great, and all the little extras on the Blu-ray are great. And it's just a great movie to share with people. We should close out by talking about the difference between ethics and morals. No, I'm just kidding.
If people want to find you on the internet, where could they look?
Oh, they can find me on Twitter at HWood Minotaur. HWood stands for Hollywood. I tweet a lot about Ingmar Bergman, maybe too much, but I just adore him. He's my favorite director. But also tweet
it's
about...
It's the year of Ingmar Bergman, so that's totally fine.
It's the year, so it's going to be even more annoying if you're not a fan of him. No, but it's his centennial this year, so it's super exciting. But I also tweet about, like, you know, I also have other favorite... I love Terminator and Star Trek and Albert Brooks, and so I tweet all about all my favorite things and about, you know, movies I see. I do tweet size reviews. On my link, if you go to my profile, there's a link to my blog, which you can check out, my 2017 Best Films of the Year list, and actually all of my Best Films of the Year list going back to, I think, 2005. And I also have like a blog I wrote about meeting Michael Eisner, who's like a hero of mine, which if you read that blog, you're like, oh my God, she's Tracy Flick, because you can see about like how I wrote down a list of all the stuff that I wanted to do to achieve this goal. And it's kind of crazy, but don't judge me. And then I also have, I also wrote about the day that Bergman died in 2007. So there's just interesting things. I also have a best of the decade list that I wrote from 2000 to 2009, which I think is interesting if you love movies. And then I work at Sony Pictures. I'm in the partnerships team in the marketing department there. And I just want to say, on the last podcast for Amelie, I plugged Jumanji, which was like, God, it hadn't come out. I think
you said it was going to be a lot of fun, and it was.
Yes.
It was so much fun.
Yeah, I even say I was listening to the end of it like yesterday, and I was like, did I plug Jumanji? And I did, and I talked about, I don't know if you believe in, if you take any stake in what I say, but that I thought it was such a fun movie, such a well-made movie, and I've been gushing about it. I'm also a regular guest on Wrong Reel. And I've pretty much been gushing about it for 6 months, and it's so exciting that it came out and that a lot of people really enjoyed it. So it's still in the theaters, so please go out and seek it out if you haven't seen it. It's really fun. And then we have a live action CGI film, Peter Rabbit, coming out February 9th, which is actually my birthday. So go see it and honor my birthday. No, I'm just kidding. And then Slender Man, which is a horror film, comes out May 18th. The trailer just came out for that. That looks good. Sicario 2 comes out June 29th. The trailer, we're really proud of that. And then I'll just stop it in July because I'm going 7 months out right now, is a Hotel T3, which is our big animated film for the summer.
There was a film I'll promise I'll cut this out if I'm wrong, but I thought I saw that it was for Sony that I was really looking forward to, about, I saw the trailer, caveman times, like during the Ice Age, like the beginning of Dogs.
Oh, like Alpha?
Yeah, Alpha.
Yeah, that is our movie.
It's like one of the Hughes brothers. That movie looks really good. I'm excited for
that.
Yeah,
that is our movie. It's I haven't got to see it yet, but the trailer's terrific.
Yeah,
it was supposed to come out earlier this year, but I think we moved the release date. And I don't have the new release date. I think it's in August now, but I don't have it. It was supposed to come out in March, but I think they just wanted some more time with it to market it appropriately. But yeah, the trailer looks fantastic, and I definitely should check it out. I haven't seen it yet, but it looks great.
Cool. And if people want to follow the show, you can cast your ballot on flixwise.com. You can also vote for us over on iTunes and even leave a review if you'd like. So that would be appreciated. Until next time, take care.